All right, guys, welcome to yet another episode of A Glass for Every Palate. Today, I am honored to have a guest that's probably one of the most influential people along my quest into wine. It is somebody that I do respect, somebody that is funny and open, and somebody that has constantly evolved and taken stock and inventory of where we are in the world, particularly within wine, and is not afraid to continue to grow and evolve as we all do. He's a new dad, which is super exciting, and a new restaurateur. And the theme of this week's episode is evolving. Welcome to the show today, guys. My guest, Dustin Wilson.
Hey, hey, how's it going? Great to be here, Shakira. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is a long time coming. You should have been among the first people that I wanted, but you're all across the country opening up shops and restaurants and all of those things. So I'm so glad that we were able to get a little bit of your time.
My pleasure, and I'm honored.
It's not like our usual guest where we need to start from the beginning, because everybody knows who you are. Everyone listening to this podcast definitely knows who you are. So I don't want to start at how did your career in wine start? So as you guys know, like, Dustin's been in the wine game for quite a bit of time, has worked at some of the best restaurants in the world. Last was EMP, which if you follow me on Instagram, you know that I went there for the vegan menu and it was mind-blowingly good. But there came a point at EMP, at the top of this wine career at the time, it was the pinnacle of where you wanted to work, that Dustin was like, all right, buddy, I'm tired of this. I can't be on the floor anymore. Let's start there. Like, you're slinging wine at one of the most exclusive restaurants in the world, having a good time. Like, this is not like a basketball player that has been playing since they're like 19 and is like, all right, I'm 30, I'm over this. What made you decide, like, okay, I've got to think about what I'm going to do when I'm not doing this?
Yes. So I think to put it into context, it's maybe good to think, to kind of walk back a little bit and talk about how I approached EMP from the beginning. And in my mind, the position at EMP, while I think it absolutely could have turned into something much more long term, I ended up being there for a little over 4 years. It could have been much, much longer. I could still be there today, I'm sure. When I started there, you know, I had always intended to kind of have that be probably the last job in that sort of role that I was going to take. Because in my mind, I always wanted to open something of my own. I always thought for a long time that it was going to be a restaurant. I always wanted to go off and do something, you know, and open my own thing. And the way I kind of looked at EMP was, and this was really driven by my time working at Frasca in Boulder with Bobby Stuckey, was, you know, Bobby had, when he opened Frasca, he had just left the French Laundry. He was the wine director of the French Laundry for a couple of years. And when he moved to Boulder and he opened this restaurant, everybody was just so excited about it because of the connection that he and both he and Lachlan had to the French Laundry. And it was crazy when you'd walk around that dining room. I started there a year later and everybody was still thinking that it was somehow connected to the French Laundry. And,
wow.
And I was like, wow, this is really incredible. You know, what that step in their careers had done for this restaurant that they've opened. I was like, I wonder if you have to just assume that if they had never worked there, if they had never done that, but they opened the exact same restaurant, would it be perceived the same way? Would it get the same reaction? Would it get people as excited? My assumption is probably not. So, you know, when I decided to kind of stay in this game and do this, it was very intentional that I was like, all right, well, if I'm ever going to do something on my own, I need to work my way into a position that's very similar to that and do that and kind of put in my time and get some credibility under my belt before I just go off and try to do something.
Gotcha.
So, you know, when I started EMP, that's how I looked at it. I was like, this is the final step. This is the last piece in the puzzle before, if I'm going to go do something that it makes sense for this place to be the launching pad. You know, I'm not going to go work anywhere as a wine director anywhere else after this, you know what I mean? This is the top. And I recognize that. So
yeah, that's the top.
You know, I wanted to do my best at that restaurant. I wanted to put in my time. I wanted to make an impact on it. I wanted to drive value for the business. I wanted to just do the best that I possibly could. But I always kind of knew in the back of my head that this was probably going to be it. So, you know, I think that culminated with, you know, getting to a point I was in my mid 30s or so when I decided to leave, and it kind of coincided with just a change in how I looked at my life from a personal standpoint too. you know, you can only kind of work nights and weekends and holidays and 16-hour days for so long before you're like, you know what? Maybe I want a family one day, or maybe I want to like spend time with my loved ones, like on the weekends, or be able to like go home and see my family on holidays. And I just got to that point where I'm like, you know what, if I'm going to go, I want to figure out how I can still do what I want to do and build the thing that I want to build. And, but do it in a way that I can balance it with the things I want long-term for my personal life too. So that, and that was the inflection point, and that's what drove it.
Have you always had like, not even just like opening your own restaurant, but has that entrepreneurial spirit like always been a part of you?
As far back as I can remember, yeah. Because when I was a kid, I was like, when I wanted stuff, you know, I remember wanting like a stereo when I was like, I don't know, 13 years old or something like that. And it was like a $200 stereo or something like that, which at the time seemed like just insanely expensive.
Really expensive. And,
to a 13-year-old kid, you know, this is, I'm not going to age myself. It was a long time ago now. And I was like, okay, well, you know, if I'm going to be able to go buy this thing, at the time I would cut lawns on the weekends around the neighborhood to make some cash. And I was like, all right, well, I need to go cut like whatever it is, like 10 lawns or something like that over the next couple of weeks. And I'll make enough money to go get this stereo. And that's what I would do. I'd like go find places to go cut lawns and like go run around the neighborhood, knock on doors, be like, I'll cut your lawn, $10, you know? and it started there. And then I remember in late in high school, I had like drawn out a logo and a name and an idea for a restaurant in a ski area, because for a long time I thought I wanted to just live in ski country. And the best way for me to balance my desire to ski with my interest in restaurants was to just do a little breakfast spot where I could like get it going in the morning and then like bounce like early afternoon and go ski the afternoon and like have my day. So I mean,
talk about designing a life that works. Like, all right, this is what I want to do.
Yeah. So in a sense, you know, I've always kind of wanted to just do what I wanted to do. And it was just trying to figure out, all right, the best way to go do that and just head down chasing that.
What I think that like people have seen the food, there's the documentary out on kind of like what the service and the level of detail at AMP is, but not really about how intense the wine program is. So when I posted recently that I went and the menu switched to vegan, a lot of the questions that I asked, that I got asked, were about like, well, how is their wine list going to work with an all vegan menu? And I think that people think that the wine list is just as pricey and out of range for everyone as the menu is, but it's not. There's actually a lot of really, really great wines at super pocket-friendly prices, considering you've paid $350 for dinner alone, that are there. So how would you describe the wine program there when you were there, juxtaposition to the kitchen and the level of gravitas, maybe? I just like that word, so we'll go with it.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, because I think the culinary program when I was there, so I started in 2011, and it was right when they got their third Michelin star, and their cuisine, and when I started too, they were doing a $75 4-course prefix lunch. So let's put that into context here.
in context.
So the cuisine like really evolved and changed over time. And that's their whole thing, right? Their thing is like, we're ever evolving, always changing. The Daniel's kind of palate didn't necessarily change too much, but kind of the philosophy of the food and the different ingredients that they would use and the presentations and kind of the artfulness and the creativity of the food definitely evolved over time and changed a lot. So, you know, the program, the wine program, on a high level, I would say, you know, when you look at it from a wine list perspective, didn't really change too much. It grew. You know, our goal was, when I started, I was like, all right, this is already a very, very solid program. John Reagan, who was the guy that was running it prior to me, did a phenomenal job with it. He won the James Beard Award for wine service. They had just gotten a Grand Award. Like, I'm like, what in the world am I going to do with this program to have any sort of impact on it? And, you know, because they had already done so much. I was like, I'm just going to like cruise on this thing. But I, you know, I wanted to try to do something with it. So we decided to just try to make it the, you know, one of the absolute best and biggest wine programs you know, in the world, and just have every great wine that you could possibly have, and have deep verticals in all of it, and you know, just really blow it out. And luckily, we had the resources and the ability to be able to do that. So that trajectory never really changed all that much, because in my mind, it was always, you know, wine is very complementary to different types of cuisine. So even if the cuisine changes a lot, you know, we're always going to have different things in the program that will accommodate that. But what I wanted to accomplish from the wine program separately was just have this become like an amazing, amazing, deep, thoughtful program, and just really broad from every angle. So the place where it shifted a lot with food was obviously with pairings. You know, and as the food got more creative, we tried to get more creative with pairings too. And, you know, we did everything from like serving champagne, you know, in like the middle of the dinner, you know, not starting mm-hmm. with champagne as a lot of places might do it. Or we had it at like course 4 or 5 or something like that. We're including beer and cider. We're including sake. We're blending things sometimes. We actually did a course where we did a play on like a black and tan, where we poured, actually it's not a black and tan, I can't remember what it's called, but champagne and a porter, a smoked porter for a course. So basically we'd pour champagne for one course, and then as you finished the glass of champagne, when it was like halfway full and the next course was about to come out, instead of clearing the champagne away, we actually topped it up with this smoked porter. So it was this blend of champagne and beer that was actually really cool, really fun and interesting, because like yeasty and toasty, but it was smoky and malty at the same time. And I can't remember what the dish was, but it was awesome with the dish.
Oh, now I'm thirsty.
So we just started doing weird, creative stuff like that. You know, the port tongs and the botrytis course that we did with like kind of spoon, the like Hungarian Tokaj spoons. We introduced that into service. So, you know, we just tried to get as creative, both from a what we're pouring point of view, as well as how we were doing service point of view, you know, as the menu, as the cuisine got more and more creative, we're like, all right, well, we got to keep up with them on like a philosophical standpoint. So what can we do? What can we do? And we'd have meetings every single week about just like brainstorming anything. Anything goes, let's just throw it at the wall and see if it sticks. So we had a lot of fun. It was great. It was just playful and no rules, no boundaries. It was awesome.
That's awesome. And I think that fine dining itself has just, the dining room has evolved, where you have much, much younger and adventurous diners and guests that aren't just looking for the classics. You know, they can have that anywhere. So if they're coming to an EMP or to any of these other establishments, they're looking for a little bit of, you know, the classic level of service and precision that the place is known for. But you also want something new. Like, you don't want the same wine that you'll get paired anywhere else.
Right.
And I think that's a testimony to the new guard.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is like, how do we not just be another 3 Michelin star big wine program? How do we make it? Like, we need it to be deep. We need it to be, have the benchmarks. But then from there, how do you make it fun and different and interesting? We did that through kind of balancing it with the natural wines and quirky stuff and things from all over the place. You know, when I started, there was 0 from the Southern Hemisphere on the program.
Really?
So you got, you know, South America, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, all that stuff was put into the program. It didn't exist there before. We started doing Eastern European stuff, like, you know, weird grape varieties. So balancing that with the classics, and then just throwing all the rules out when it came to service, just kind of being like, all right, what weird stuff can we do in service that just positions us as creative and thoughtful, but how do we do it in a way that kind of fits the brand of EMP too, which is very precise and professional and, you know, on point. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. You can always sense that. Like, when you go somewhere to eat, you can most times sense if the staff is actually enjoying what they're doing and really believe in what they're mm-hmm. doing. And I will say that I've felt that now. We're in a different time now where a lot of people have shown that they were not as happy as they appeared to be to their guests. But I do think that, like, at that level, it's very difficult to be new and innovative because so many people have so many expectations of exactly what it should be, that any type of change mm-hmm. or modification to anything can either go really, really well or can get you like shredded. That's interesting to try to figure out, like, what's going to work in a place like this.
Yeah, it's funny because we honestly, from a wine side, we never really asked the question of will it work. We were just always like, do we get excited about it? And is it, could it be fun? Is it going to be fun? And if those were the two answers, then we figured out a way to make it happen. And that was what was cool. And I think what kept everybody really engaged and excited all the time.
Do you still approach wine that way?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm like, it's just different. My world is so much different now than it was back then. I mean, I know it's only been, how long has it been? I guess it's been 6 years. So I guess it's been a while, but, my whole world is just so much different. So it's hard. Like, I guess me personally, I approach wine in a similar way that I like to try new stuff. Like, yeah. I think part of the fun of wine for me is finding like the new cool producer that's really exciting, that makes delicious stuff, or, you know, tasting something from a new place, from a different grape that I haven't had before. That's really tasty and fun and delicious. And as you probably know, when you're in wine for a long time, that those opportunities become smaller and smaller and smaller because you have tasted so much over time. You start to get a little bit bored, you know, you're like, all right, well, what else is there? And so when you find new stuff, you get really excited.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question to you. Like, having tasted, like, I think that, you know, the idea of the exam and being at these places, everyone kind of almost romanticizes it, and that you've gotten to taste everything, like all these iconic wines and producers and vintages that people will probably never taste in their life. Like, you've gotten to taste, like, how do you still get excited about anything? And you have now, is it three, right? Yes. New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. You got three retail locations, three different sets of clients and patrons in those places. How do you still select wines that you get excited about?
Yeah, it's definitely a different strategy, and you kind of take a different point of view with it, because with retail, it's much different than restaurants in the sense that, you know, when people walk into a retail store, they're looking for something that they just want to drink, and they're going to drink it off-site. You don't have the opportunity to pour it for them and see their reaction. You don't have the opportunity to pour it, you know, next to a plate of food, or pair it with something specific, or be there in service to kind of explain why this wine's exciting and what they should be tasting and walk them through every piece of it like you can in a restaurant. So in restaurants, it's much easier to get people to be adventurous and try stuff. Where in retail, it's just not, you know, most of the time people just are like, you know, I like what I like, and I just want to find something that I like for the dinner that I'm doing tonight, or I'm taking to my friend's house, or it's more, it's a lot more utility in that sense. So when thinking about that from a business owner standpoint, or even just a person that's helping in the store, you want to kind of have a selection of things that you can still be adventurous, but you also have to, you kind of have to do it more within a framework of, like, what do the people in this neighborhood really enjoy? What are the people that come to shop here looking for? And what are they like? You're really just trying to understand the tastes and the preferences of your clientele, and then, you know, making sure that you have your bases covered there, instead of just kind of going wherever you want to go and then trying to convince people to drink something. It's more like, all right, how do we make sure that we're taking great care of everybody in Tribeca, or in, you know, lower half of Manhattan, or wherever we're delivering wine to, you know, not necessarily have maybe exactly the right brand that they're looking for, but have something that's very similar from a producer that is, you know, makes wine in a way that we get really excited about. So we're balancing kind of, you know, the desires and what our guests or what our consumers are looking for with stuff that also gets us excited, if that makes sense. It's less of, you know, we just throw whatever we want into the program, like you can do in a restaurant, and get you jazzed up.
I have an interesting question for you. What do people love from a retail perspective that you don't get why they love it? Like, it's just not good to you at all, but people love it.
Oh, well, goodness. you know, if I have to answer this question, and this is by all means, this is not a knock on this wine, and I hate to, I don't like to talk bad about any wines. But it does amaze me from time to time how much it sells and how much just people go nuts over it. And I personally just don't like drinking it. It's not that it's bad wine, I just don't like it. It's Sancerre. Sancerre just
really?
Absolutely flies. It flies. And I'm just, it's like, delicious. I don't get it. I don't get it.
What?
I mean, listen.
I did not expect that at all.
Yeah, there's some very specific producers of Sancerre that I actually really enjoy, but I tend to like them because they don't taste like Sancerre or they don't taste like Sauvignon Blanc. I think it's more for me. I just don't like Sauvignon Blanc as a grape variety. I'm not into it.
It's like
weird to me. But so that's a personal preference. But Sancerre, just, it doesn't matter who the producer is. It doesn't matter what it tastes like. If it's Sancerre and it's like $20, that stuff is just absolutely flying off the shelf. Flying. It you can't keep it around.
Yeah.
You just move through immense amount
people
of it.
People love
it's,
it.
It's nuts. They do.
All and right, well, what's
for
the
me,
reverse?
I'm just like, I don't get it.
What do you love? Oh, man. I love Sancerre. Okay, I'm going to give you the reverse, though. So what do you absolutely love that you think people are resistant to? Like, why aren't you guys loving this? It's amazing, but you have a harder time convincing people how good it is.
That's a good question. I wouldn't say, I guess the two things that pop into my mind first are grapes that I wouldn't say people don't like them. It just surprises me that there aren't more people that like them because they don't fly, and you usually have to convince people to try it. Once they try it, they usually like it, but it's not like their first choice. And that's both Rhone varieties. So it's Syrah and Grenache. And not to say that people don't drink them. They definitely do. There's a lot of people out there that love it, but it's the average consumer. It's not in their, usually in their first picks. You know, they're usually going for Pinot Noir or Chardonnay or Cab or, you know, something like that. Even Gamay and Beaujolais is like, you know, way more popular right now. But for me, like Syrah, great Syrah is like one of the greatest red wines in the world to drink. But I always have to convince people to try it. So maybe my taste is just off, Shakira.
I agree with that one. I don't think people realize how versatile Syrah is. So I think that they've had one Syrah that likely, from my conversations with people, the one Syrah they had, they didn't like. And so I think a lot of people do that, in that if you have something,
so they write it off.
Yeah, it's done. I'm never ordering that again because I ordered it once and it wasn't good. I think with both Syrah and Grenache, I don't think that people realize how versatile and how many different styles those grapes can be made in and how different they taste depending on where they're from. So I wouldn't disagree with that. I thought you were about to say Viognier. I'm going to say that grape. I feel about Viognier the way you feel about Sancerre. I found one that I actually like.
Yeah.
One.
Viognier for me is, it's a very, like, I don't dislike it. I don't love it. It's like, sits in this very neutral middle ground for me. I like it when it's like the right dish that's being paired with. But I'm never going to drink like Viognier by myself, like on the front porch, like as an end of the night drink or something like that, like to kick back. It's just not.
No, not ever. It's not.
But
that,
you pair Viognier
kind of party
with like a really beautiful piece of like foie gras pate or something like that, that has some peaches or something with it. That's like stone fruited, nice. Or maybe even like a more savory presentation with like sunchokes or truffle or something like that. And Viognier is lights out with specific types of things. It's just, it's a pairing wine for me. It's not like a drinking wine, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But so many people love it. And I'm like, okay, hey, drink what you like. I'll take whatever else you
right.
have. That's not.
People should just drink what they like. That's why I don't like talking bad about anything.
Drink what you like.
Oh, I don't like XYZ. People should just drink what they like. And I drink what I like, you know, that's just the way it is.
And that's, but I think that that's an important part of like reminding people that like, just like somebody that you deem to have more wine knowledge than you or a more experienced palate than you, that's still just a person with preferences based on what they've tasted. So
100%.
I could not like something that somebody else absolutely loves. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like just because 100%. I don't like it now. If I say I don't like that wine because it's poorly produced, that's a different conversation.
100%.
But if I say, yeah, I just don't like that, you know, and I think so I think it's important for people to recognize, like, look, everyone has preferences in something.
Yep.
And that's why I love, like, I mean, Verve, all the Verve locations have such a wide variety of things for every palate at every price point. I loved working there. I learned so much. I met so many amazing people. And Goodman's, oh my God, if you lived in New York, how long is Goodman's open again, by the way?
I think they just reopened the bar. Yeah.
Okay, fun. If you lived in New York,
I know, I go back.
We have to go back. If you lived in New York, Goodman's is a bar that's actually located in the men's store of Bergdorf Goodman. So for those that don't live in New York, Bergdorf Goodman, huge luxury department store, but it's actually on two opposite sides of Fifth Avenue in the middle of Manhattan. But if you went to the men's store and you went upstairs, there was this amazing, like, cool, chill, almost roaring 20s-esque amazing bar with great wine, potato chips, and caviar. And you guys know how I feel about that particular item. And it was just great food from an amazing chef that you're now opening a restaurant with. How did we go from like bar with incredible bar food, like bar food that's not really what anyone thinks of when they think of bar food, to now we're opening a restaurant? Like, tell us about what we can expect at One White Street.
Sure. So One White Street, I'll try to be as quick with this as possible. One White Street is a new restaurant with my business partner and chef, Austin Johnson, who is the former executive chef of Frenchie in Paris. He also spent time at 11 Madison Park, spent time at the Nomad. He spent time at Noma in Copenhagen, amongst other places. Spent 6 months on a salmon fishing boat in Alaska. The guy's done like everything.
Jesus.
Super talented, cool, just fun, amazing person. And this little restaurant is a four-story townhouse that we took over that's right on the corner of White Street and West Broadway. So if you know where Frenchette is or Batard, we're like a couple doors down from them. It's very small. We have, you know, a little less than 600, a little less than 600 square feet
I'm
per
like,
floor.
What?
Yeah. Three floors of dining. So it's like, call it 20 seats per floor, roughly. And, we basically have taken the idea of like what Frenchie was. And if you've ever been to Frenchie in Paris, it's this very cool little restaurant that operates two different concepts. There's Frenchie Restaurant, which is a, like, I think it has eight tables or something like that. And it's about a 6 or 7 course tasting menu that it's a tasting menu and it's elevated, but it's also really fun. Like, they play loud music and the staff has, you know, like tattoos and their sleeves rolled up and they're just like having fun serving you and pouring cool, interesting wines. And it's no fuss, you know, it's like none of the pretension, none of the buttoned up, like, you know, stuffiness of like high end, Michelin star dining. It's just really authentic and fun and delicious and, creative. And then on the other side of the street, they've got Frenchie Bar Oven, which is, you know, more relaxed, even more casual, high top tables, a la carte dining, more rustic food that's meant to really go well with wine. And, you know, Chef really loved working there because he got to kind of work with two different sides of his brain from a culinary standpoint. It got to be a little bit more tweezery and sophisticated with the restaurant food. And then on the wine bar side, you know, could kind of just have a little more fun and keep it rustic and playful. And he liked being able to do that. So when we found this space that had these different floors, we're like, what in the world are we going to do here? We, you know, basically were like, well, let's take that same idea of Frenchie and kind of turn it vertical instead of across the street. So what we have is the first floor of this restaurant is think of it as like a loungy bar atmosphere, but with tables, you know, so you can come in and have full dinner. And that's, think of it as like the bar of inside of Frenchie, where it's, we've got a couple of high tops, it's a la carte dining, we're not taking reservations, it's walk-in only, it's more rustic, playful food that's killer with wine. And then upstairs on floors 2 and 3, we've got a reservation only tasting menu, 6 courses, that's a little bit more polished up and refined and elegant, so to speak. So that's kind of the idea, and the influence of the food is, you know, really kind of taking this global approach where we might use ingredients that are, you know, you see on menus in Japan or you know, Spain or South America or something like that, or, you know, you might see more traditional American type things. You might see French stuff. It's kind of taking pointers from all over the globe, not saying like, oh, this is a French restaurant, this is an Italian restaurant. It's you know, chef's background is very French influenced, and he's got a lot of technique from that world. But the ingredients and the flavors, I guess, that we will use, the inspiration for the dishes can really come from anywhere. And then the other piece of this that's really important is we have this little 6-acre farm upstate in the Hudson Valley in Columbia County, New York, called Rigger Hill, that we basically designed from scratch with the farmer, Danny, who is running it now. And they're growing all of our produce. So not all of everything we use will be from the farm, but a big majority of things that are on the menu will be coming from the farm. And what that allows us to do is be really creative and kind of grow things that are a little off the beaten path, instead of the go-to normal types of things. Like, we've got like 10 different types of basil, for instance, growing up there. We've got like 16 different tomatoes or something crazy. It's like a lot of really interesting stuff, a bunch of different peppers and things like that. So, you know, and they're driving down 3-4 days a week to drop stuff off at the restaurant. So that's kind of the idea. You know, Austin and I are both, we like, you know, refinement in our experiences, and we like being thoughtful and sophisticated with what we do, but we also just like to have a good time and like not be stuffy or, you know, too pretentious about anything. So we just like to be chill and have fun. So that's, we're trying to like inject some of that into it. Like, let's make it really cool and interesting and fun and sophisticated from a culinary and wine standpoint, but let's make it like chill, like not, let's unbutton ourselves a little bit. Let's roll our sleeves up. Let's turn the music up and make it fun. Yeah. So that's the idea.
Because it can be both, right? And I think that we haven't seen a lot of spaces where it's both. And it's funny, like I thought about that a little bit in like restaurants that I've been going to now, and like we have this big trend of like dress codes. And I'm really torn on dress codes because I'm a dresser. I like dressing up. And there's a part of me that feels like it's grossly stuffy and exclusionary for some dress codes. But at the same time, if I'm paying a lot of money for anything, I also am paying to be in what I feel, because I'm going to say it's absolutely perfect, in a certain type of environment. So it's great to see, you know, like spaces expanding and it not being about, I mean, everyone I know, I'm like, shoot, well, you guys know, I'm going to be 40 this year. But I don't feel 40, whatever 40 is supposed to feel like. Like, I feel like all my friends are just like relatively young. We're not really good at things that we used to be good at, i.e. sports or anything like that. But, you know, we like nice things, but we don't need, you know, a white glove, or everyone doesn't need to have on a blazer to have a good time. You know, so I think that, you know, hearing that it's this kind of best of both worlds and the same, because sometimes you do want like an elevated dining experience where, you know, 15 hands had to put this little circle of a dish together. Totally. And sometimes you just want to open bottles and let your hair down. So it'll be really cool. I'm super excited about, also for anyone that doesn't know, 600 square feet per floor. If you ever had a friend that lived in a really big studio apartment in New York, that still probably wasn't 600 square feet. So that is what each floor, I think that people, a space in New York is a commodity. So 600 square foot, if it was a studio, that is a nice big studio at 600 square feet, because most certainly aren't. You know, in opening a restaurant, you guys have an amazing wine director who happens to be a really good friend of mine, who I met working at Verve. Her name is Audrey Frick. She's amazing. Our time at Verve together, Audrey has definitely become like one of my best friends, and I adore her. And it's really good to see, you know, a very, very diverse team in opening and building a new restaurant, especially where we are in the world. And so we can't talk about opening a new restaurant and building a team and creating a culture, we can't not talk about like how the world of hospitality has evolved since everything that's happened. And because, of course, you've been such a major figure in this world, I don't even want to ask a lot of the, well, I know a lot of the questions that have been asked about you and about who you knew and what you knew was going on and all of that. So let's talk a little bit about taking all of that into consideration, how did you approach building a team and an environment for a team that is equitable, that is safe, that gives everyone agency and makes everyone feel like they're not just a part of a cog system that's supposed to make guests feel good, even if it's at their expense?
Great question. So I'll start with the leadership team and management, and I guess how we've approached this from the very beginning, which is we're very intentional saying like, okay, let's, Austin and I just looked at each other. We're like, all right, dude, you know, let's talk about the elephant in the room here. We're two white dudes. So this is very important, and it's something we care about anyway, but it's very important that we make sure we surround ourselves with a lot of different types of people, not only because it's the right thing to do, but also because it's very clear to me that, and we talk about this a lot internally with the whole team, is you need people who think a little bit differently than you do, who challenge you, yeah, who don't always see things in the exact same way. It's important that we don't have just a lot of people that think exactly the same and look at things exactly the same, because while that might seem like a good thing in some ways, because everybody's just, they understand my vision and they're, you know, what we want to do and what we want to accomplish and whatnot, it actually leaves you susceptible to a lot of holes in your philosophy and a lot of the ways that you think about things and the way you operate. So I think for me, it's become very clear that in order to make sure that you're running a good business and you're running a restaurant that thinks about things on a lot of different, from a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different levels, you need people on your team that think about it in that way too. You need people to say, well, hey, well, what about thinking about it this way? Or, hey, you know, if we did this, it would come off poorly because of X, Y, and Z that I might not know, that Chef might not know, that someone else on the team might not know. So the more different types of people that you can surround yourself with and put on the team, I think the better it is all around for the business, for the guests, for the experience, because then you have a lot of folks that just have a different mindset on everything. So I think it's really important on that front. And, you know, from day one, once we brought the rest of the team on, which we were also very intentional to make sure that we tried to balance that as much as possible, is, you know, made it very clear to them that they're super important to us, and that we value everyone, and we value everyone's opinions, and we want to hear from them. And I wouldn't say that we're necessarily running this place as, you know, a restaurant by committee per se, but we also try to make sure that everyone gets a voice at the table. So if we're going to roll new things out, or if we're going to talk about something, that we get everyone's input before just making decisions on things, so that we can make sure we're being considerate to the team. We've also made it a solid point internally. We're not making noise about this to the public per se, but my opinion is, if, you know, guests are disrespectful, they're not welcome back, or they're going to be out the door. Like, that's just the plain and simple of it. I mean, I'm doing this, and I know Chef's doing this, and a lot of us are doing this because we love this industry and we love being in restaurants and we like having a good time and we want this place to be fun. And frankly, if guests come in and they're just assholes for whatever reason, like, we don't need that. And like, I think we can make enough people happy, and Manhattan's filled with enough good people that we just don't need that around us. So, you know, I think making it clear to the staff that, you know, if and when they're ever made to feel uncomfortable, that we'll take action on it, is very reassuring to them. And I'm not saying that we've thought of everything. I'm not saying that we're perfect. But, you know, from the way I look at things and the way the leadership team looks at things, we're trying to be as thoughtful about this as we go into it as possible, and remain open-minded to, you know, how we can always improve and evolve over time. So that's it. You know, we're just trying to stay, you know, as open as possible to everything, and not be too stuck in our ways on stuff.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I don't know if any of that makes sense.
No, of course. It does. I mean, I think that this last year has been a learning curve for a lot of people. And I think that one thing that I've observed and I've tried to is, like, there's some shit that's unforgivable, right? That, like, there's no way you did this and did not know it was wrong. And if you did, then I just think you're a bad person, to be honest. And there are other things that if your lived experience never needed you to be mindful of it, you didn't even realize that you might have been doing something that is not helpful and causing harm to other people. And totally. So I think, you know, we have to have these conversations. You know, the whole fiasco of the court, where the truth is, a lot of the people that got called out for being really vile people are people that you knew, people that you're friends with, and people that for a lot of it, you caught a lot of shit for being associated with them. So a lot of by proxy stuff. I want to ask you, post looking back at all of that stuff, two questions. Like, one, what do you think is the one thing, like, if the court stands and goes on as an institution and an organization for the next 20 years, what's one of the values or the tenets of it that you think should stay because it really helped you and shaped you as a professional? And then what's something that, not even in the court, just you as a person and as a man that came up in this industry, what do you wish you would have spoke up about or called out or just been able to change sooner?
So
we can go with the first one of what should
stand.
Yeah,
I'll answer those in order. So I think the most important thing that the court does that they are good at is education and making people, you know, pumping out sommeliers who, I'm going to try to think about how to frame this in the correct way, but sommeliers who, from a service perspective, know how to do things correctly. Because I do think when it comes to service, there's a lot of elements that can be interpreted and customized, but there's also kind of some right and wrong in there too. And I think the other piece is on the theory side or like just understanding wine, not necessarily how you explain it or how you talk about it, because I've learned over this last year that there's a lot of different ways that you can describe wine and talk about wine that can be more accommodating. But I do think that it is important that you understand kind of the factual information about, you know, how wine is grown, how it's made, the different grapes and what the scientific kind of composure of these varieties are like, and what the wines taste like, and what the structural components are, and how winemaking affects flavor and things like that, that I think are really important when it comes to guest interaction. And, you know, at the end of the day, sommeliers and wine professionals are salespeople. You know, our jobs are literally trying to turn guests on to new things or trying to sell something to them. So making sure that we're armed with the correct information. Now, how you disseminate that information can be massaged into a way that I think we've all realized can be done in a more inclusive and thoughtful way, depending on the audience and depending on what works for them and things like that. But I think what the court is good at are those two things. So making sure they're pumping out sommeliers who know the rights and wrongs of service and how to do it properly, mm-hmm. and also are really good at understanding kind of the information that I think we all need to know. I think when you start to move too far away from that and you start to leave too much stuff up to interpretation, you get away from kind of the factual information, and you start to degrade the industry to a certain extent. So I think those two things are really important. The court does a really good job at that. I'm not saying they're perfect by any stretch, but I think those two things are important for the industry long-term. And currently I don't see any other organizations that do it to the level that they do it.
Okay.
So the other question, what do I look back on and kind of think, what could I have done better? The first moment to me that seemed like something was maybe awry, just made me feel kind of like weird, was, and I've talked about this publicly before, was actually the day that I passed. So I was in Dallas when I passed. We were at the Four Seasons. And when you pass, you get invited to dinner that night with all the other MSs, and it's like a whole big thing. And, you know, it's like, you know, you're in the circle now, you know, you get to hang with all of them, and mm-hmm. it's no longer, you know, the teacher and the student or any of that anymore. It's you're part of the crew, and you get invited in, and they talk to you differently and they treat you differently. And I remember we were at this dinner, and it was like, you know, it's like me and McClintic was like a couple people down from me. And I think, I can't remember who else was at our table. There's a bunch of tables. Anyhow, the point being, mm-hmm. there was a few moments in the night where we were asked to, like, it was almost like fraternity hazing to a certain extent, where it was like, we were told to stand up, sit down, just randomly. We'd be like in the middle of eating. They're like, "Hey, newbies, stand up, you know, sit down." Okay. Then they'd like you know, shit talk a little bit. And then, you know, we'd have to like say dumb things from time to time. I can't remember what it was, but I just remember going through these motions. And I remember looking over at Brian and I'm like, what in the frick is going on? What is this? This is so dumb. And I'm like, this is what it is. This is what we joined. I'm like, this is kind of weird and insane. And so that was like the first little kind of impression that was made on me that the organization was still, you know, this was now 10 years ago. The boys club mentality felt a little like a frat thing. And at the time I just kind of brushed it off. I was like, I guess this is just what it is, you know? And I didn't think much of it. And I was like, it didn't occur to me that that sort of mentality or that sort of culture could unravel into the types of things that, you know, have unraveled over time since then. I didn't think like, oh God, if they keep acting like this, then something bad is going to eventually happen. And this is going to really mar the organization and da, 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 da. It's not like, okay, this is weird. And I guess this is what we're in now. Cause I guess that's it, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess looking back, I wish I would have maybe taken a longer term view on that and maybe been a little more scrutinizing earlier on and maybe brought it up in an earlier time and thought about it in a different way. It didn't really like piss me off per se until the cheating scandal in 2018 when, you know, I just thought that they went about things in the wrong way. And it also felt to me like there was something that was being hidden. And I just, something about it just didn't feel right. And I spoke out about it. And the backlash that I got from a bunch of VMSs was really off-putting to me. And that for me was like, you know what? It just really pissed me off. And I haven't fully recovered from that yet. Because I, you know, I tried to speak up, I tried to do it in a professional way, and you know, I just got kind of whipped for it. It sucked.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I think if I would have gone back in time, I would change the way that I maybe approach things and gone about it a slightly different way.
You know, it's always funny to me when I like, in hearing that, I'm like, well, I cannot imagine anyone that is Black or a woman being in a room with a bunch of older white men barking out commands to them to sit and stand and speak. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, as a white man, it's just weird to you. Like, why the fuck are we doing this, right? Mm-hmm. As a woman or as a Black person, that takes on a whole different nuance of
totally.
Like, what
right.
is happening in this place? You know what I mean? And so I think that, you know, in seeing, in having a lot of the veil pulled back of hospitality, one of the things that it's not surprising, because I think like when we think back to growing up, you always had like your guy friends, and those group of guy friends would always tell you like, stay away from that guy. Don't be alone with that guy. Right.
Right.
And it always struck me as weird. Like, why are you telling me to beware of them? You still hang out with them. You still go to parties with them, and then you warn women about them. Why don't you tell him to stop being a blank creep, right? And so in this environment of all the things that's happened, I think that's a fair question to you, who I tremendously respect, but that's a fair question to every man. Like, if you would warn women about being around this person, why? And the answer could simply be, I never thought of it. Or men don't check each other's behaviors. But why do you think, is it just that that was the culture of it where no one said anything to anyone else? Because it seems like so much of this stuff was public that everyone around knew what was happening. What stopped everyone? Like, would it have been that detrimental? And the answer could be yes to anyone's career if they called out that kind of behavior.
So that back then, that behavior to me was, it felt weird, but to me, it didn't at the time seem like something that was like, at least I didn't take it this way, to be like offensive or anything. And, you know, like I said, I just kind of brushed it off and I was like, okay, I guess this is just how they are. It's a little bit of a, you know, bro-y kind of atmosphere. And, you know, being a dude growing up around guys, like you're used to those sorts of environments. You just kind of expected that when you join something like that, you wouldn't necessarily get that, but is what it is. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I had personally never heard of anything to like, let's just name the article that came out last fall. I had never heard of any of those stories rumbling around. And to be clear, well, I guess a couple things. One, I'm not going to make excuses for men in general. And I also don't want to talk too broadly about And I also don't want to talk too broadly about just the organization, because there's a lot of really good people in the organization too. You know, it's gotten a lot of bad stuff said about it, but there are individuals within it that are also like awesome and that I am very close with. And I think it's just great human beings.
Absolutely.
So the people that I was hanging around, and frankly, you know, was mostly just New York. And after I passed, I was at EMP, and was anything I had to do court oriented was always based in New York. You know, I would do my classes at ICC and the intros and certs that we would do there. And I would see the same couple of people, and that was it. You know, I don't like hang out with them per se. I would hang out with like my couple of buddies that that lived in New York that were MSs that we would see each other from time to time. But, you know, up until actually none of the people that I personally hang out with were named in that piece. So I don't think on my level personally, and again, I can't speak for everybody, I just never saw anything front and center that I or heard of anything personally that I would have ever called out. I'm not trying to make an excuse for it by any stretch, but it just, had I heard that something really terrible had happened, I would have liked to hope that I would have brought something up. I just wasn't that close to anyone. I don't know what else to say about it. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean,
here's what I want to say about it. It doesn't surprise me per se, as when I look back to think about that first night, you know, when I think about just kind of some of the bro-y types of people that are part of the organization. It doesn't surprise me per se, but those types of people I never really liked to hang around to begin with, not because I knew anything bad about them, just because I didn't jive with them personally.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what else to say.
Do you see things differently now? Where, you know, I think that a lot of the thing, the hardest part for all of these situations, like outside of line, like Me Too and all of it, is that there is an inherent fear in people that are being harmed to say something, even to people that they respect, because they just don't think that without, you know, a videotape of the episode that anyone's going to take them seriously. How, you know, approaching having three retail shops with employees, now a restaurant, a bar, how do you think and how have you really created an environment where maybe it's not you that they talk to, but that if somebody is being harmed by somebody, there is a clear outlined path for them to say something. Because I think that in a lot of that, that's what was missing, was who the hell am I going to tell without causing more harm to myself?
That's absolutely part of the issue. And I think, you know, when I look back at it, nothing ever bad ever happened to me specifically. So outside of getting a little whipped up when I brought up the how I didn't like how they handled the 2018 scandal. But, you know, I can definitely understand how people may have felt scared to ever say anything about anything, because the culture of the organization was kind of like this, just shut up and get in line and act appropriately and don't badmouth anything. That was just kind of the culture of it. So I can understand that if something bad did happen to someone, it's probably very difficult and very scary to try to bring it up. And at the time, there was no outlet for it. There was nothing. And, you know, this is something that Bobby Stuckey and I talked about a lot post the 2018 thing. Was like, you know, actually before that, actually, we've talked a lot about like you need outside HR, you need somebody who's not an MS running this organization. It needs like a CEO. It needs some more structure, because it's not this little club like it used to be. And this is a worldwide, ever since the Saw movie, actually, it's a worldwide organization. It's growing, it's popular, it's in the public eye. It's not the same thing it was back in the 90s. You know what I mean? So, but they were acting the same way. So the piece that was missing, that I think where they kind of goofed up, was they never took a look in the mirror at a certain point in time and said, hey, our organization looks a lot different now than it did 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We maybe need to button ourselves up a little bit and put some more structure in place, i.e. get somebody running this whole organization that's not one of us. Get some HR that's not, that's like third party, that people can go to if if and when anything ever happens. Those pieces were missing. So as an individual that maybe had something bad happen to you, if you had nowhere to go, the only place you could go was higher up the chain. And like those people are there to protect right. the brand. They're there to protect themselves. They're there to protect the organization. Their interests are not aligned. So it's,
right.
it was an issue. Now those things are changing. Like now they've implemented that stuff. It took a hell of a lot to get them there. We all know what happened over the last chunk of time, but they're doing it. You know, for me, I think about it the same way. I'm like, okay, well, you know, Verve started out as this little shop in Tribeca. We had, you know, myself and basically three other employees for the first year and a half or something like that. It started to grow. We opened up store number two, and now we're opening up store number three. I'm like, all right, well, you know, we've got to start putting more structure into place. And, you know, we've got now, it's been well over a year, we've had, you know, third-party HR, so that frankly, like nobody has to come to me. I don't want people coming to me if something happens. If something bad happens, like it's the same sort of problem. They don't want to be coming to the boss. You know, what happens if the boss is the problem? You know, you need another outlet. So,
right.
So, you know, we've had that in place. It makes me feel a lot better as a business owner. It makes me feel a lot better for my team that they've got a place they can go that's safe, that's third party. Frankly, it's all run by women. So it's like, just a good, safe place for them to go to if and when something bad happens. I think that stuff's important.
Yeah, I recognize
as a business owner now, like the time that it takes to build some structure, you know, and I think the court maybe just took too long to do that. And I think I would encourage other business owners as they, you know, open things and they do things to try to make that a part of it. You know, as soon as they can, responsibly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anything would have changed if the things of last year did not happen. I think that it would have been exact same organization with the exact same people gatekeeping, and it would have just stayed that way. And I think, to be fair, I think that would have been the case in a lot of places, like not just the court. There are so many instances now where people are pointing out, no, this is not new. This is not as of George Floyd. This has actually always been this way. You know, I had a conversation with someone the other day where, I mean, and I think we have to talk to each other, right? Like even in wine, I'm like, we spend so much time talking. We can talk about a glass of wine for 2 hours and have a fruitful conversation, but we can't talk about other things. And I mean, that's my takeaway from this, is that we're talking more. Because I had a conversation with someone the other day that literally never recognizes mm-hmm. how many men are in a room at any given time. And I'm like, well, as a woman, it's really hard for me to walk into a room and not notice that I'm the only woman or the only person of color. It's not that I'm looking for it. It's that you walk in and you scan a room and you can quickly see that. And I'm not scanning it mm-hmm. for gender. I'm not scanning it for anything. I'm just looking around the room to see where I'm going to move to next. It's very easy. But if you are always the majority, it's very hard to see that. It's hard to see how just the mm-hmm. composition of a room can be uninviting and uninclusive. And I think the more we have these conversations, we still have a lot of work to do as a society. I think that there are still a lot of people in power that have some work to do. But I do give grace to people that we're all in this human experience. Like we all do have to, we have to fuck up. We have to atone for our fuck ups, and we have to learn and grow from them. And I think that as long as people are willing to do that, we have the potential to do better. And that's the best we can hope for.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Oh my God. Okay. So we had some fun. Now we got to have a little bit of fun. We have talked about your business. We have to have some fun now. Okay, so we got through the first one. So this is kind of like a speed round. Can't think about it for too long. You already got out of the hardest one, which was, I was going to ask you if a grape varietal can go away completely, never to be consumed again on the planet, what would it be? But you've already told us it's Sauvignon Blanc. Sad. So sad. All right, if you have a shitty day, everything that could possibly have gone wrong in that day has gone wrong, what do you want to drink at the end of that day?
Probably some bourbon.
Bourbon. Okay.
So, well, I would say specifically, if I was going to sit at a bar afterwards, it would be probably a Manhattan. That's my go-to.
Okay.
Not wine.
That's a solid drink. Definitely not wine. No one says wine. No one says, oh, after a shitty day, I just want to have a nice glass of wine. Like, absolutely not. All right. Best day ever. Everything's firing on all cylinders. Everything's going great. Nothing has gone wrong in the day. What do you have when you go home? What's the end of the night drink for you there?
Oh gosh. There I would probably want to pop open, like if I've got it sitting around, a nice bottle of like Northern Rhone wine or some fun Grenache, I would say. One of those two.
Okay. On average, how many bottles of wine do you keep at home?
Probably like two cases. Not much.
Oh man, that's good. Is that pre or post pandemic?
That's post. Pre is less. Pre okay. was probably like three bottles.
Wow. Okay.
I don't have much wine at home.
That is interesting. I would not have expected that. I'm actually now embarrassed and will not talk about how much wine sits in my apartment at any given time. Okay. Biggest misconception about fine dining?
That the servers or the team doesn't have any fun. They're very serious on the dining room floor. And you get them back into the kitchen or, you know, back in the server stations or something. They're just as goofy and fun as quirky as anyone else.
They are. They should. People, if you haven't hung out with restaurant staff, like when they're not working, they're some of the best people ever.
Totally.
Funny enough, the question that someone asked me about that was, I don't understand how anyone is full after eating those little plates of food. I'm like, well, you eat 10 of them. So you're full. Don't worry.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Promise that you're full. You're not leaving hungry. Okay. What is the lowest price you think, considering the US market, somebody can pay for a bottle of wine that is good, but I'm defining good not according to taste or palate, but it's good based on this is a well-produced wine, whether I like it or not, this is a well-produced wine. What do you think is the lowest price point?
What's the lowest price?
Yeah.
I would say $25.
$25 gets you a good, well-made bottle of wine. I agree with that completely.
But I would say, this is the other thing I want to say. Can I answer like the more of the first question too?
I think
a misconception about people when it comes to wine or about wine when it comes to how people think about it is that the more expensive it is, the better it is.
What a lie.
I think when you get past, I don't know what the exact price point is, but once you get past, let's say, like $100 a bottle or something like that, maybe 125 or somewhere in that range of like, let's call it $80 to $120. Once you get past that, it's no longer about the quality or flavor. It becomes a rarity and supply demand issue and brand. So as it gets more and more expensive, you're no longer paying for higher quality fruit or better winemaking per se, or better, you know, better taste per se. It becomes much more of a supply demand rarity equation that drives price. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it's then preference.
Yeah. So for me, the price range that I think you get the most bang for your buck is like, I don't know, call it $30 to $65, $75, something like that.
Okay, fair. Fair. I certainly would not disagree with that. I think that if you like Spanish wine, you can even go to the $20 price point and still find great wines. Certainly, if you like Portuguese wine, you can find lots of great wines for even lower than that. But I think that as a general rule, I absolutely think that that's great. Okay, last question is super fun. What or where should people be drinking from right now? Like, what are you excited about? What's the bottle or the grape or the region that people should be like, oh my God, I want to try this?
I feel like I've been saying this for a while and I wish I had a different answer, but it's Grenache from Spain.
Yes. Yes.
I still can't think of anything that I personally, right now, I still get super excited to drink it, is like a really great Grenache from Spain.
High elevation Grenache from Spain.
And more specifically, I'm usually talking about Commando A.
But yeah, obviously.
You know that.
People know that. People know how I feel about those wines.
Yeah.
I agree completely. This has been such a dope conversation. I would definitely keep you for like 2 hours more. We could touch on so many more topics. This was so great. Before we wrap up, I want you to tell everyone where they can follow you, where they can pop into Verve and meet some cool people and grab a great bottle, and how they can make reservations for One White.
Awesome. So you can follow me on Instagram. My handle is @DustinWilsonMS. Verve Wine is, if you're in New York City, it's in Tribeca. It's at the corner of Greenwich Street and Hubert Street, kind of the west side of Tribeca. Right next to the Citibank building. Come in anytime. We have Verb San Francisco, which is in Pack Heights, right on Fillmore and Washington Street. And then in Chicago, in Lincoln Park, right on North Lincoln, basically North Lincoln and Halsted, and the new development there. Come see us. We have a restaurant there, so we can take care of you. Follow Verb on Instagram, too, at Verb Wine. And then lastly, One White Street. Reservations are available 30 days out on Resy. And you can follow the restaurant on Instagram also at One White Street, all spelled out. O-N-E-W-H-I-T-E-S-T-R-E-E-T.
Dustin, thank you so much. Let me wrap this up. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening in for another amazing episode of A Glass for Every Palate. I'm going to take a second to thank Dustin. And the entire team at Verb really has been so instrumental in me learning more about the business side of wine, the retail side of wine, how to become a better taster, and just an infinite amount of knowledge. So I am so grateful to all that you've contributed and continue to contribute to my wine journey. It's a true honor to come full circle and have you as a guest on my podcast. So thank you. That's my mushy moment for the day, everyone.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Aww.
And guys, until next week, cheers.